Hello and welcome to episode 9 of series 5 of the Engaging Internal Comms podcast. This is the show for employee engagers and internal communicators who like to keep up to date with all that is new in our profession. My name's Craig Smith from The Big Picture People. Just a quick introduction here, just to let you know what we've got coming up in our next couple of episodes. On the 23rd of April, I have an interview with Christy Garcia from Mindful Choice Coaching. Christy is going to be telling us all about the role of ego in communication, and a topic that we've not covered before. Very important, really interesting interview that I had with Christy, which I think you'll find really valuable. And then going out on the 7th of May, I have an interview with Melissa Hackmeyer from Merck. This is a second episode that we've covered Melissa's work at Merck. Previously, it was right in the middle of the pandemic, where she was doing a lot of virtual engagement work with her volunteer workforce. So Merck has a fantastic volunteer program, really, really fantastic work that they do. And now, that obviously after the pandemic is over, they're now back into the face-to-face world. So the work that Melissa is doing there and how that program has changed and ramped up, and also how they engage volunteers and make that part of their employee engagement program, really fascinating. It was fascinating before, and it's really interesting to see how that's evolved now that all those restrictions have been lifted. So that's what we've got coming up in the next couple of episodes. We are currently looking for new guests for the show. We've had a lot of interest in the past. If you've already applied to be a guest, please bear with us. We will get back to you. But if you are interested, please use our form at engagingic.com, where you can find where you can register your interest, or email us at info@thebigpicturepeople.co.uk, and we will get back to you. We just ask you to fill in a quick survey just so we can find out what it is you would like to talk about, what your topic is, and as I say, we will get back to you as soon as possible. So let's get into this show's interview. Persuasion is something that is really important to us as employee engagers and internal communicators. It's something that's inherent to our work. We're trying to get our messages across. We're trying to help our leaders get our messages across in a way that people are convinced by and want to change their behaviours and mindsets, if that's the themes that we're looking at within our communications. So it's really important that we have an understanding of what persuasion is all about. And there are many different terms that get conflated with persuasion. Argument, influence, manipulation are all different terms that we can use for a very similar purpose, a very similar end goal, sometimes with good intent and sometimes with bad intent. And obviously, as internal communicators, I'm hoping that our internal communications and our communications have positive intent. So what we're going to be exploring in this episode is, what is persuasion? What is persuasion all about? And can we break persuasion down into elements that we can use in our work to make our communications more effective, more engaging, and more likely to have the impact that we're looking for? We're going to find out all about the three elements of argument, emotion, and character. And they're not just new, they're an ancient way of looking at persuasion, and break those down into different elements that we can use to dial up and dial down our communications. We're going to look at the dark side of persuasion. Like any medicine, it can be a poison as well if used in the wrong way. And persuasion is a similar thing. And particularly in our current political climate, it's something that we're probably all interested in. And we're going to be looking at how you can persuade at scale. Persuasion is something we maybe think about on an individual level, but on a corporate level, when we're trying to communicate with hundreds or thousands of employees, persuasion is an important element to our communication work. So that's what we're going to be looking at in this episode, and we're going to be speaking to a real expert on the subject of persuasion. My guest today is Carlos A. Alvarenga. Carlos is an independent researcher, writer, and executive advisor. He's also a PhD student at the University of Maryland, where his research focuses on the language of trauma and totalitarian regimes. Before writing full-time, he worked as a management consultant and an adjunct professor at the Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. Prior to his current role, he was the executive director of World 50 Labs, the member innovation team at World 50 Inc. Before World 50, he was principal of Ernst & Young's advisory practice and earlier a managing director at Accenture. So, hello, Carlos. How are you?
Hello, Craig. Thank you for having me on today.
It's an absolute pleasure. Whereabouts in the world are you, Carlos, just for our listeners?
I'm based in Bethesda, Maryland, which is home to the National Institutes of Health here in the US. So it's just outside, just north of Washington, D.C.
Fantastic. That's pretty good for anyone, but anywhere, no matter where in your world, I think we all know where Washington, D.C. is. So I've given quite a detailed account of your very, very esteemed resume there, Carlos. But tell us a little bit more about your current work and also kind of what's led you to what you're doing now, please.
So as you noted, I had a career in management consulting. A few years ago, I decided that I had enough of the travel. I was spending a lot of time in the air, and I wanted to research and write full time. So I left business, started writing, created a digital research journal, published my first book, which took me 3 years to research and write and publish last fall. And as you mentioned, I'm currently doing my doctoral work around rhetoric and persuasion at the University of Maryland. So I say I'm a student and writer are my two main jobs.
Excellent. So tell us a little bit about what that current work involves, and maybe if we can then lead into a little bit more about you, the subject of persuasion and your fascination with it, which is what today's interview is all about. Well, tell us a little bit about that, what that looks like in reality, please, Carlos.
Yeah, and I'll tell you about the origin of the book. So when I left full-time business work, when I began to do research, I wanted to volunteer. I was looking for a way to give back to the community. And I came across a website that matches volunteers with nonprofits who have projects. And the very first project I came across was a gentleman, a very senior gentleman who is chairman and CEO of a global international relief agency. And his project was, help me to be a better speaker, help me to be more persuasive, help me to be a better communicator. When I talked to him, I realized that in watching his speeches and in reading what he was saying to people in his PowerPoints, that he hadn't really thought about what he was doing. You know, when it comes to persuading an audience, it wasn't that he was considering, which is understandable because we don't study this anymore, right? Mm. And so I said to him, "Listen, I think it would really be helpful if we take a step back and think about how persuasion works and how does that apply to what you're trying to do." I picked up a few books on persuasion. None of them I found out were really about persuasion. Some of them were about manipulation. Some of them were about influence. Some of them were about negotiation or selling. And I was looking for something that just talked about what exactly is persuasion? How does it work? Because I couldn't find one. I went back to a book I'd read in college, which is The Rhetoric of Aristotle, which is the original sort of text on this subject, no, at least one of them. And I made a PowerPoint deck of the book. And I took this gentleman, this executive, through this deck, and I said, "If you learn what's in this deck, I think you'll be shocked and pleasantly at how much better you get in your communications." And so, he did. We did a second project a year later. I'd done a dozen of these sort of one-on-one coaching efforts on persuasion, and my wife said, "You know, you should really write this down. You've done a really nice job of expanding Aristotle." I said no. She persuaded me to do it. And 3 years later, the book is now available.
Okay. What's the name of the book? We'll put some links into the show notes about the book, Carlos.
The book is called The Rules of Persuasion.
Yeah.
And the subtitle is How the World's Greatest Communicators Convince, Inspire, Lead, and Sometimes Deceive.
I like it. I like the little subtext there at the end. Yes. okay. So that's really, really interesting. So I guess that tells us all about where that fascination came from. You mentioned when you were talking there that about you know, the books that you found were when they said they were about persuasion, but they were actually around sort of manipulation, influence, etc. Maybe in that context, then it's worth just explaining or defining your definition of persuasion, because I guess it is a term that does get conflated with argument, influence, manipulation, etc. They're all of those different words that have very different implications to persuasion, I guess. So maybe if you could give us your working definition, please, Carlos.
Sure, I'll give you Aristotle's, right? Because his is mine is. And Aristotle says, persuasion is a demonstration that something is true or appears to be true. And so that's a very simple statement, but it has many implications. The most important one being that we don't persuade, truth persuades, or the appearance of truth persuades. And he says in his book, there are three modes of accomplishing this phenomenon or this conclusion. One is the character of the communicator, And that could be a person, an institution, a school, a company. It can be through the arguments presented, things like logic, proofs, witnesses, evidence, authorities, etc. And then there is the emotion that the audience feels as the message is received. And those emotions can be positive, negative, religious, mystical. And so that is the basic thesis that he presents. The reason I wrote my book is that Aristotle has an interesting trait, and that is the more obvious something is, the less he explains it in many cases. And so he makes this remarkable statement about the modes. And so you may have heard it called ethos, pathos, logos in articles about persuasion. But the thing that I struggled with was, okay, but what do you mean by that, Aristotle? When you say character, what exactly do you mean? By the way, what exactly is persuasion? And so I kind of became obsessed with answering this question. And what I say in the book is my expansion, or my part two, is when we think about character, there are seven parts to character. There are seven parts to argument, and there are seven kinds of emotion. Think of these 21 elements as a kind of periodic table. And every message delivered from person to person, or God to person, divinity, is some combination of these 21 elements, which means that persuasion is kind of a chemistry with words. And when we persuade effectively, we have found the right combination of elements, delivered it in the right way, and we affect persuasion in an audience.
Excellent. I'd like to explore that a little bit more. I've also made a note to come back to this concept of truth, and we're going to talk about that in our kind of modern world at the moment. But let's, before we delve into that, let's, if we can, Carlos, just explore that periodic table that you've just alluded to. And I know it's always difficult when people are listening to a podcast to kind of list things, so we'll put some of these into the show notes. But so each of those different elements, according to Aristotle, or argument, emotion, and character, have each of those have seven sub-elements. Is that correct?
The three modes are his. The sub-elements are mine.
They're yours. Okay. That's how you've helped kind of expand them. So as I say, we may just need to list them. But maybe pick one or two in each category. Yeah. So is it argument, emotion, and character? Is there any particular order to them, or is that really dependent on the situation?
Depends situation. You don't have to use all three.
Yeah.
And the way I talk about it sometimes is, imagine if you have a persuasion machine that has three dials, one called character, one called argument, one called emotion. You can dial each one from 0 to 10, right? Or 11 if you're a Spinal Tap fan. And whenever you set the dial, that's kind of the technique, right?
Yeah.
That is the formulation. In a commercial, for example, or in a package statement, the dials are fixed. Once you create that message, it goes out. If you're speaking live, then you can adjust the dials
to the audience
as you go.
Yeah.
You know, with the appropriate skill level.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I used the analogy of a graphic equalizer, but that means very little to a lot of people nowadays. So yeah. So okay. So let's then maybe look at the argument, and then just maybe, Carlos, if you could just give us the kind of the seven sub-elements of argument, and maybe just elaborate slightly on each of them if that's okay.
Sure. So in argument, we have the elements are antecedents, so what has happened in the past, authorities, people you say, the CEO, the head of a famous institution, right, a professor, evidence, interrogation, which are questions you ask an opponent or a witness or the audience, logic, laws and standards, and then witnesses.
Okay.
And a good example of antecedents, which is very common in the world of businesses, what has happened in the past? So when you hear, we don't do it this way, that way in this company. Or we always have a retreat and only these people are allowed to go. Those are antecedents, right? And so we use those to try to persuade someone that that is the right way of doing it. And the force is that it's always been done this way. If you think about character, which Aristotle says, if you had to pick one of the three, which is sort of the most powerful, it's character. And within character, we have an element called origin. So origin refers to where you come from. So because this is very important, because we believe that argument can kind of come and go, or it can be made up on the spot, but origin seems fixed to us, right? So where someone's character was forged, where it comes from, is very important in terms of persuasion. Right? So language, history, what we know about your past, categories, the groups into which you can be placed, right? You can be placed to the group called people who host the podcast, right?
Yeah.
Executives, et cetera. And so status, which is the power of the speaker relative to the audience. So these elements, when we think about emotion, right? We've got positive emotions, things like joy, happiness. We have negative ones like anger. We have inspirational emotions, positive, right? Mystical, sacred, which are the ones related to religion. So the great communicators look at this list of things and say, okay, here's the combination I'm going to use to affect in the audience the acceptance or the belief that what I want them to believe is correct.
Mm-hmm.
And if they believe that, then they will buy, follow, work, lead, you know, whatever it is that I'm trying to get them to agree.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So just summarizing what I took though from those three categories, then argument for me, I'm kind of paraphrasing as that's either kind of rational or logical kind of concrete elements of this equation. Is that fair to say? Yeah.
Sure. That's a good way. Yeah.
And then emotional obviously is the kind of more, you know, the kind of the emotional, it's kind of doesn't need any definition, I guess. And then the character is the transmitter of the information, and it's your sense of connection with them and their how like you or different to you they are, but also other elements of that character as well.
That's right. So emotion is really, again, what is the audience feeling as you communicate? And then character is, who is talking to me, right?
Yeah.
What do I know or believe about the person or entity or institution which is trying to convince me of something?
Okay. It's really interesting, actually, because episode 4 of this season, I interviewed J.J. Brunn, which is an episode that obviously went out before yours. And he was a contact handler for the Canadian military intelligence. And I know I'm just recalling one thing, a conversation we had, which links to character, which was one of the really important parts of his ability to connect with, you know, kind of, he was working in war zones where he was having to kind of make connections with, you know, kind of warlords and people like this, where we, you know, he could find out what was going on the ground. And a lot of what he was saying is around, you know, was that where I know where you're from, and that mutual understanding of who you were, you know, he was transparent about who he was and what he was doing. And he had to be really, really careful about how he did that. So it's really interesting, you know, as I sort of thinking in a really different context, but absolutely backs up what you were saying there. And in terms of the, you know, practically how you would advise people, you know, is it literally a case of sitting there with your periodic table of those 21 different elements and, you know, and your graphic equalizer and turning up those dials and being very, very kind of deliberate about that? Or as you said, I think you said also there's an element of being intuitive enough to be able to sort of read the situation and to kind of have the knowledge and the depth of understanding to be able to sort of dial those up and down as the situation demands. I guess it's a combination of both that you kind of advise and work with your clients to sort of help them to understand. Yeah,
absolutely, Craig. And I think the most important thing is awareness. When I meet people and I ask them to define persuasion, which is the first question I always ask, finish the sentence, persuasion is ... And people really struggle. So it's hard to be good at something that you can't define clearly, right? And so what I find usually is that, especially senior leaders, what happens is that because they haven't thought about character as a persuasion element very much, and because they often struggle with emotion, they overuse argument. And so what I explain to them is, imagine that you're moving in a ship with three masts, but only one sail is unfurled, right? The two are tied up. That one sail is doing all the work. So over time, it gets a little tattered. It gets overused. And the very first thing that I work on with people to say, let's start thinking about you as a person or your institution. What of these seven elements could you use to be more persuasive that's just sitting there unused today? Then when we look at emotions, it's the same thing. Have you ever thought about what you want your audience to feel? How you want them to feel? What emotion are you trying to elicit? Are you eliciting an emotion without having thought about it, which is often the case? And so we now work on, right, moving the emotion dial from zero to two or three or three or four, same thing with character, moving the argument down from sometimes it's peaked at a 10. Let's just dial that back a little bit. Let's balance it out. And suddenly the message changes and they feel much more relaxed and much more effective. Mm. It's interesting how many times I work with people who say, I'm a nervous speaker, I don't like public speaking, and they think it's about mechanics. And what they find is that the reason you're nervous is that you haven't thought about the core message ahead of time. Once you understand the message, suddenly all the mechanics go away. Mm. And you actually even enjoy it because you're comfortable with what you're trying to say.
Mm. I agree. One of the things we talked about when we were talking about the definition and using Aristotle's definition, as you mentioned about truth, and I said I was going to come back to this, and I know when we had our preliminary conversation, I was intrigued, you know, it's in the subtext of your book as well, the kind of the dark side of persuasion, and using your periodic table analogy, which I know this is your analogy, not mine, is that any compound that you put together can be a poison as well as a medicine. So I'm just intrigued, particularly, I don't want to get political, it's not a political podcast, but obviously we've got some strong winds of political change, both sides of the Atlantic this year. We've got an election, you've got an election. And, you know, again, regardless of political viewpoints, truth is not as objective as it used to be, it appears. I'm intrigued about your perceptions, and particularly your work around trauma and totalitarianism as well. What is that dark side, and how do we help people to distinguish between the two? Because there's probably a very, very thin and permeable line, and it's about perception, I guess, as to whether we're being persuaded or manipulated.
Well, there's a chapter in the book which is the dark side of persuasion, and I wrote the chapter because once I had fully developed the idea of chemistry, right? This metaphor of chemistry, it occurred to me that chemistry is amoral. It can be used to make medicine. It can be used to make poison. Mm. And so the question became, if someone is using language to poison us, can we see that in the language? And I came across a remarkable book called The Language of the Third Reich, by a guy named Viktor Klemperer, who was a philologist who lost most of his position, you know, social position and wealth during the Nazi regime, but wrote about it after it was over and survived, the era, and wrote an analysis of the language of the Nazis. And as I read his book, it occurred to me that, and he uses this metaphor, we were poisoned as a people, that he described phenomena in language that I thought were markers. Right, they were indicators of someone trying to poison a people. And so I described 9 of those markers. And the reason I picked those markers, I say in the book, is that all are present in our American social discourse today, which means that I believe that there are people trying to poison society with words. Mm. Because what we see in the Third Reich, we see again today.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on that. It's quite scary, and it's ironically about 100 years on, isn't it? So, what are some of those markers? And you know, again, I'm not in any way trying to substitute the rigor of your book, but just to try and sort of just give an illustration.
Sure, let me give you one. Right, so he and this is Klemperer says that the most effective thing that the Nazis did in persuasion wasn't the big lie, which most people have heard about, right? It's something that I call language blurring. So what is language blurring? Let's say you and I are driving through a forest, and out of the corner of your eye, you see a shiny object in the forest, and you look at me and you say, what was that? And I said, it was a man playing the trumpet. A few minutes later, the same thing happens. And I say, it was a man playing the trombone. One more time, the same thing happens. And I say, it was a man playing the saxophone. Well, guess what? You stop asking me what it is, because you now are convinced that there's a orchestra in the forest. And so he says, you would have speeches of Hitler and others that just ran 24 hours a day. And so you heard it so much, it just became blurred in the background, right? You didn't even know why you thought something, because you forgot where it came from. And when I hear people today who say, I hate this person, or I hate this policy, and then I say, well, can you explain the policy? And they have no idea what it is.
Yeah.
Or they don't know why they hate that person or why they think this person's a terrible person or enemy of the state. Then you say, okay, well, that's remarkable. This message has just been flowing. And in language blurring, the communicator doesn't want you to pay attention very much, right? They just want you to absorb it. So that you see almost every day in America. Mm. You have something called dislocation of value. And that is, imagine if you could alter the numbers on a scale or the altimeter readings in an airplane, you dislocate the value. So in the example of the Nazis, what they did was to say, all people are not equal. There is a group which is superior, right? And these were the heroes, the athletes. Hitler loved racing car drivers for some reason. So racers, great soldiers. So first we say these people are inherently better than the average German, right? They go up. That's only part one, though, because once you've accepted that people are not all equal, now comes part two, which is, oh, yeah, and this group is lesser.
Mm.
People who are mentally, in their words, right, who are mentally defective, who are Jews, who are this or that. And so you begin to put in people's minds this idea that some people are better, you're probably average, and then some are worse. And then you finish the job and you say, oh, yeah, that group that we convinced you is inferior or not as good as the other of us, they need to go. Right? So when you see people start to say this person is somehow morally inferior or not as good as we are, right? Then you have this dislocation of fundamental human value, which is a very dangerous thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what I'm taking from that then is that whilst there is a potential thin line between manipulation and persuasion, there are some markers that we can look out for that will kind of give us that those tells and those indications. Because, yeah, it's hard to sort of see a positive reason you do some, at least those two things that you've talked about, for a legitimate reason other than subliminal manipulation, I guess.
No, some of these are kind of simplistic, and some of them are very sophisticated techniques that take time to put into place. It might take 5 years or 10 years for one of these things to sort of do its job. But eventually what happens is that the funny enough, the paradox is that the ultimate aim of a corrupt persuader, I say in the book, is to kill persuasion itself. Mm. What does that mean? It means that what they ultimately want is not to have to persuade you, right? They just want you to do what they tell you to do.
Mm.
Mm. They want to make it unnecessary. When they want to say, they want to get when they go, kill that group, you kill that group.
Mm.
Oppress that group, you oppress that group, right? That is the ultimate game, to make it so embedded, to have poisoned your mind and your ability to reason to the point that you just stop using it.
Mm.
And you simply execute on the message which is given to you.
Yeah. Okay. Just to sort of bring things back into a business context, and obviously that does have business context. So, but more to maybe a kind of more positive, but back to persuasion and away from manipulation. The podcast audiences is internal communications, employee engagement. Often, they may be coaching or guiding leaders, very much in the kind of context that you talked about there, where we were kind of persuading on an individual level. But a lot of them will be kind of persuading at scale. They may be communicating and engaging hundreds, thousands of people within their organization. So I guess my question is can the things you've talked about, can you scale them up to and obviously you the context that you've just given there in terms of the more manipulative side of things was obviously at scale. And what would you advise, how do you recommend that they use that? Because obviously that is a very diverse audience that they're reaching out to, who may need different things. They may need different blend of argument, character, and emotion. What would you recommend there, please, Carlos?
Right. So it does scale, right? In the book, I talk about advertising, great persuasion in campaigns that Apple has run and Nike has run. And those are at scale. You're talking about millions or tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of people that are going to be receiving this message. The rules work in those contexts as well. The most important thing is to think about first the audience, right? And I talk about there are four kinds of audiences that we confront. That's one of the chapters in the book. And what audience am I addressing? And what are the things that the audience believes, right? What does it have in its mind at the time that my message received. And then to think about the right formulation. What do I want to communicate that is common across that audience that I wanted to believe? And one of the most important things here is this, what I call foundational truth, right? So a foundational truth is something which must exist in order for your message to work. And I'll give you a good example, and that's Nike. To the best of my knowledge, Nike has never run an ad saying that exercise is good.
Yeah.
Right? It assumes you believe that. So for Nike, exercise is beneficial to the human body is a foundational truth. Oftentimes, especially in business, executives assume that they understand foundational truth or that a foundational truth has been accepted by the audience. For example, that they're likable, right?
Yeah.
And then what turned out later is that, you know what? That's not true. So the message that was built on the fact that my employees like me didn't work because what you assume to be foundationally true is not true. For example, I work with a chief digital officer who his problem was that he was trying to get people behind a digital transformation effort, quote unquote. And for him, for the leadership team, this is a very important thing. But for the average employee, they hadn't accepted that as true. So no matter how great his message was that, hey, we have to change, we're in a crisis or an inflection point, it hadn't been accepted by the rank and file there. And that's why the message was sort of falling flat, right? So he had to take a step back and say, okay, if they haven't accepted that, then that's the first thing I must persuade them of.
Yeah.
Because that's foundational to my subsequent message of how we're going to affect that transformation.
Yeah.
So I'd say in a business context, when you're dealing with scale is ask yourself, what must fundamentally be true in order for my message to function? And then ask yourself, all right, what is the right formulation that I'm going to give? And by the way, here's where delivery method becomes very important. So again, if this is chemistry, right, and I have medicine for you, there's a reason why some medicine is in a liquid, some is in a capsule, some is in a pill, some is in a syringe, right? And so because different delivery methods affect us in different ways. And the same thing comes here. I'm always surprised that people haven't thought about the method in which it's being delivered. So are you speaking live? Is it video? Is it audio? Is it in a text, right? Is it in a PowerPoint deck? And they work on the message, but not the method. And it is in the method that the message fails. So you think about those three things, right? Just to recap, what must be true foundationally within my workforce, my audience, my customers, my stakeholders, for my message to be accepted? What is the right formulation? And is the delivery method supporting the message or not supporting? And if it's not, can I adjust the method so that it will support what I'm trying to affect, right?
That's really good. No, I like that summary. And there's a couple of things there that resonate with me, Carlos. Well, all of that resonates, but a couple of things in particular. One was the last thing you talked about around the method, which is I know and we talk about this a lot on the podcast, or I listen, hear a lot on the podcast, is this, you know, kind of preoccupation with different channels, particularly obviously post COVID. That's kind of been a proliferation of different ways of communicating, which is fantastic, but not all of them are suited to every message. And I think there's a bit of a, you know, a kind of kid in a candy shop sort of a mentality there, where we've got all these fantastic tools, but, you know, we're using them, but we're not always necessarily fully thinking about how we use them. So I think that's one element. I think the other part of it is exactly what you were saying back at the beginning, which is really understanding the truth, or our understanding, or what needs to be fundamentally true for this to work is that, I mean, we've been working with an organization at the minute which is very prone to thinking that its own, you know, around the senior management team's version of the truth is the universal truth that everybody within the organization has. And that's always a really dangerous precedent to take, because, you know, it might be, you know, they're maybe a little bit more cavalier about the way that they manage the business, because they're, you know, fundamentally going to be okay because they'll be able to get a job somewhere else, whereas their workforce maybe aren't as lucky. And just assuming that people aren't frightened about this kind of legislative change that's on the future, because we're not worried about it, you know, can lead you into those sort of avenues of kind of, you know, you're kind of talking to people but you're tone deaf because you don't really understand what it is they're worried about and what they need to hear to be able to engage with what you're saying. So that really, really resonates with me, Carlos.
Let me make one other book. I think you're right about everything you said, Greg. And that's the other one is this, right? So I talk about in the book about persuasion versus coercion.
Mm.
So coercion is getting someone to do something by force, right? Persuasion is getting you to do something through free will. And what happens in business in many settings is that, especially leaders who haven't thought about status, right? What are the elements of character? Is that they think they're persuading, but they're really coercing.
Mm.
And the example I use is your boss stops you in the hallway and gushes about a business book that she just read and really, really, really recommends that you read it. So is she persuading you or coercing you?
Mm.
Because it's clear that she wants you to read this book. Now, she's not going to make you read the book, but it's pretty obvious that it would be good if you read it and discussed it with her, right?
Mm.
So, now, what is the implication of that? It's that if you are coercing, however subtly, and you think you're persuading, when the decision is stressed, it falls apart.
Mm.
So I'll tell executives, imagine your most important initiative or your most important belief, right, or principle. If it walks out the door with you every night, you are coercing.
Mm.
Right? Because if you quit tomorrow, if you had persuaded the workforce that this was a good thing, it would live on after you.
Yeah.
And when I was a consultant, I would see this time and again where we're on a huge project, a lot of effort, a lot of money. An executive quits or gets fired and the whole project is shut down.
Yeah, 30 yeah, absolutely.
What does that mean? It means that no one had been persuaded, right? Or no one who had the power to continue it. It was lit there because of coercion.
Yeah.
And this is a really tricky issue to get right in many cases. And so I think that one other element of this would be to say, okay, as I do those three things, right? Foundational truth, formulation, and delivery method, let me be extra clear and extra sure that I am not walking up to that line, because once you cross that line, then your message is in trouble because the audience becomes alienated if they feel that's the case, right? So I think that, and with all these things, you know, Craig, the thing is that, as I mentioned in the book, we don't learn this in school. So I tell people it's okay that this may feel a little bit artificial at first because it's something new. It's like playing the piano. Mm. It's one of the strange things that almost every job I can think of depends on persuasion to some extent.
Yeah.
And yet we are not taught it. It's as if everyone had to play the piano to be a CEO and they just put a piano in front of you and said, start playing.
Yeah.
And you say, well, I've been picking. It doesn't matter because your promotion depends on you playing, you know, the symphony, piano concerto from Mozart. And so, and by the way, the music gets harder as you go up the ladder.
Yeah.
So my take is, look, a little bit of study, a little bit of reading and using this, it just becomes second nature over time. And it's really funny when I get letters from readers or people who have read the book and said, I did exactly what you said in a meeting and everything changed. And they're shocked. And I'm not. I tell them, chemistry is chemistry, right? If you follow it, it'll work.
Fantastic. Well, I think that's a fantastic point at which to finish on, Carlos. Thank you so much. That's been a really fascinating interview and I've taken a lot from that. And I think in terms of, you know, contemporary relevance in the world that we live in, and I think both kind of corporate and a societal level, I think it's really interesting and gives a great insight. So what I'm going to suggest is that to our listeners is we kind of follow up on some of the things you've talked about there. One certainly will be the book. So we'll put a link in to find the book. Is that available on all usual book distribution outlets, Carlos? Can we find it?
It is. It's also on audiobooks and I did the narration.
Oh, so wonderful. Oh, wow. Well done.
Is there. So yes, if you like to hear books, you can hear it. It's on Kindle, it's on Audible, it's available on Amazon worldwide. So
well, I'll definitely be doing that. That's going to be accompanying me on my my runs for the next few weeks, I think. So I'll be downloading that from Audible. That's great. And what about you, Carlos? I'm going to put the link into your LinkedIn profile, if that's okay. Any other links that you want me to put into the show notes if people want to reach out to you and find you?
Sure. They can reach me through my author page, which is just carlosalvarenga.com. You can read about my other projects and media projects that I've had, and also contact me if you like.
Fantastic. Well, we'll put those links into the show notes. So if you're listening to this and you've forgotten, just head across to engagingic.com, find this episode, and you will be able to see those links at the bottom of the page in the show notes. Fantastic, Carlos. Well, that's absolutely brilliant. I really enjoyed that conversation. It was one I've been looking forward to. And I wish you all the best for the rest of this year. And hopefully we'll see some positive use of persuasion and not that coercive manipulation that we're maybe a little bit fearful of at the moment in our current world.
Rick, thank you for having me on. Thank you to the listeners for listening to the episode. And I wish you the same thing. Have a great year.
Thank you, Carlos. Take care. Bye-bye. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Engaging Internal Comms podcast. If you've got any ideas for episodes you'd like us to cover in future, you can email us at info@thebigpicturepeople.co.uk, or you can use the feedback form at engagingic.com. If you're not already subscribed to the show via your podcast platform, please do so. And if you could leave a review for us, that would be absolutely fantastic. We have links to other episodes at engagingic.com. All of our previous episodes are available there. And if you're interested in our visual communication services, our big pictures, our learning maps, our explainer videos, and also our live graphic recording, please get in touch with us again at info@thebigpicturepeople.co.uk. Thank you.